In May 1945, peace came to Europe as Hitler's empire lay in ruins. But the powerful coalition that had so recently defeated Nazism itself disintegrated as the two new superpowers, the USA and the USSR, vied for influence and control across the globe. To explore the origins and development of the Cold War from 1945 to 1962, I'm joined by Robin McPherson and Sam Guttridge from the Wellington College History Department. In the closing months of World War II, Hitler's propaganda minister, Joseph Goebbels, predicted that the USSR and USA would come to blows over the future of Europe. Robin, why do you think that he believed this was going to happen?
I think it was no surprise that America and the Soviet Union were likely to come to blows after the war, so Goebbels is not saying something that others hadn't already thought. And the reason for that is the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 was something that the other world powers, including the Americans, had reacted very negatively towards. So when we see a civil war breaking out in Russia in 1918, America contributes a force along with the British, the French, the Italians, the Japanese to try and unseat the Bolsheviks. And the reason for this is that the Bolsheviks have actually tried to pull out of the war straight away, which gives the Allies a problem because they want the Russians to keep on fighting against the Germans. So they get involved in the Russian Civil War to try and bring back a government that will keep on fighting the war effort. That fails, so they pull out, but the Bolsheviks don't forget this, especially when you've got people like Winston Churchill saying things like, with the Bolshevik Revolution, they should strangle the infant in the cradle, which is a horrible thing to say. And the leader of the Soviet Union going into the Second World War, Joseph Stalin, particularly remembered that and had a serious animosity with Churchill. I suppose the only thing you'd have to say about Goebbels' statement is that he was talking about Roosevelt's America, and Roosevelt took a slightly different tack with the Soviet Union. He was the first American president to recognize the Soviets in 1933 and was certainly much more tolerant towards them in Tehran and Yalta. But it did seem likely because when the war broke out, America and the Soviet Union and Britain were not on the same side. The Soviets had signed a deal with the Nazis. It was well known that capitalists didn't get on with communists. So it seemed likely that that wartime alliance would break up once their common interest of defeating the Nazis had gone.
And to say the least, this was an unusual alliance of Britain, America and the USSR. Robin, could you add any details of areas where they fell out on? Even during their wartime alliance?
Well, absolutely. I mean, going back to the start of the war, when Britain is fighting alone in Europe against the Nazis, because the Americans remain neutral and the Soviets have got a deal with the Nazis, so they're in completely the wrong position in that sense. And then, of course, the Americans come into the war when they're bombed by the Japanese in 1941. The Soviets come into the war when they're invaded by the Germans in Operation Barbarossa in 1941. So the three of them come together. But even then, this alliance is fairly tense. The Americans want the British to decolonize. Stalin wants control of Europe. Stalin's got his eye on a buffer zone in Eastern Europe, which goes completely against what Churchill wants in terms of democracy. So we see these tensions creeping in. So the big conferences at Tehran, but especially at Yalta and Potsdam, become increasingly acrimonious because of these underlying tensions.
Sam, Robin has just mentioned the two conferences of Yalta and Potsdam in 1945. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened at these two conferences and how they set the scene for some of the later tensions in that relationship?
Yes, thank you, Alistair. Here we've got 1945, just at the closing months of the war. We've got the three victors deciding what to do with their spoils. They have these vast lands and they have got to deal with a number of serious issues quite urgently. The population themselves, the people, how Germany should be treated, how the defeated countries should be defeated, and indeed where the borders should be put and reparations and those kind of issues. And the very different ideologies that Robin's talked about clearly led to very different views of where the post-war world should go. And so the victors met on three occasions. We've had Tehran, but the two I'm going to concentrate on are Yalta and Potsdam. And here they met to address these ideas and these issues and to come to some kind of decision. But unfortunately, these decisions were quite ambiguous, as I will explain in a moment. So Yalta then. Yalta was in February 1945. Hitler was not dead yet. Germany was still fighting. The Red Army was occupying much of Eastern Europe. But as a whole, the conference was, in a way, was fairly cordial. They got on quite well, the three leaders. If you can imagine, they both had made personal sacrifices leading three countries, two or three of which were wars of survival, And so they had a lot in common in some ways. And they agreed four main things. First one was that Germany would be split into four zones of occupation, that the Soviet Union would join the war against Japan. They set up the United Nations, and also some vague agreement was made that Poland would move westwards. So Yalta broke up with a poorly Roosevelt, with a very strong Stalin and Churchill winning this extraordinary war. But over the next few months, tension increased. And if I can draw your attention to Poland, I think this sums up the tension very, very well. Here we've got the Red Army, the Stalin's army, occupying Poland, the land between Germany and his own country. And there were two incidents in particular which showed that this was not going to be an easy peace. Firstly, that to almost weaken Poland before independence, to get rid of the elite and the senior leaders of that country, the young and future leaders and the older leaders, 20,000 prisoners of war, Polish prisoners of war, were simply executed at a place called Katyn in Poland, a shocking war crime. And then the Warsaw Uprising. If you can imagine the scene, the Red Army is on the border just a few miles from Warsaw on the River Vistula, about to take the city, and the residents there rose up against the Germans and to take advantage of the situation and liberate themselves. What did the Red Army do? They stopped. And these Poles, perhaps 300,000 of them, died in this horrible battle.
Sam, what you're telling me here is extraordinary, that the Soviet army actually, rather than helping the Poles defeat the Russians inside Warsaw, actually sat back and allowed the Germans to fight and defeat the Poles in their uprising. What does that tell us about Stalin's attitude to the Poles?
Well, he wanted to control Poland. He saw it as a crucial buffer state. Poland before the First World War, in fact, was part of the Russian Empire. He cared little about the wishes of the people of soon-to-be liberated Europe. I think, again, we've got this issue as well. It can be seen in the so-called struggle between the Lublin Poles and the London Poles. Poland, in a way, had two governments. The one based in London was Western-leaning, and the one based in Lublin, I think, modern-day Ukraine, somewhere around there, was, in fact, Soviet or Russian-leaning. And who would be the new government? And those issues just were not resolved at Yalta, and of course these would come back later.
You mentioned the division of Germany, but can you say something about the special arrangements that were made for the city of Berlin itself?
Yes, at Potsdam, agreement was made to split, to split Germany to four zones, and also the German capital into four zones too, but within the Soviet sector. There was also tension too, just before Potsdam. I thought I'd just briefly mention was Roosevelt had died, so we got a new Truman who was much less conciliatory towards the Soviets. Hitler died, of course, and Germany had surrendered. So that now there was an urgency to these issues, and the Far East War was dragging on. So they met in Potsdam.
I just wanted to draw attention to something you said a little bit earlier on there, Sam, about Poland, which I think is an excellent point to make. For Stalin, it's an issue of security because, as far as he's concerned, the Soviet Union or Russia has been invaded three times through Poland in his lifetime. So it happens at the outset of the First World War when the Germans come through Poland, or what was about to become Poland. And then after the war, when the Russian Civil War breaks out, the Poles are very successful in taking a huge chunk of territory from Russia at the end of the Russian Civil War. So naturally, the Russians would like that back. And that's why Poland is due to move westwards. And then, of course, in 1941, the Germans invade through Poland in Operation Barbarossa. So as far as Stalin is concerned, Poland is not a country with people whose views should be respected. It's an open gateway for the West to attack him. So it's a huge security concern. And that's why Stalin's priorities post-war is to try and shore up Eastern Europe so that he can make sure that the Soviet Union is not attacked again. I think any country that's been attacked in three major brutal conflicts, you know, in the space of a generation would probably feel the same way. But that's not the way Churchill felt about it. It's not the way Truman felt about it. And of course, for Stalin, it's not just a question of securing Poland, but all of Eastern Europe, which brings in the other countries. And what are you doing with the defeated Germany? What are you doing with Hungary? And so on.
We've heard the name Winston Churchill mentioned several times already now, and obviously the wartime leader who was present at Yalta and at the beginning of the Potsdam summit, but is then out of power, is removed in a general election. He, of course, gives a very famous speech in Missouri in 1946. Would one of you be able to tell me a little bit about that speech and why it became so famous?
Yes, 1946, barely a year after the end of the war, and Winston Churchill was out of office, came to deliver a speech in the United States, and it was extraordinary in its tone. It was very critical of Soviet ambitions in the world. It claimed that Stalin and the USSR was going to take over aspired to take over and spread communism throughout the world. But a tiny bit of context here is the Long Telegram, or Kennan's Telegram. George Kennan was a diplomat in Moscow, an American diplomat, a real sort of Russian specialist, who was asked to sort of consider for Truman what the ambitions of the Soviet Union were to be after the Second World War. And he did not hold back, and he said that the Soviet Union needs to be stopped, and otherwise it would its communism and its ideology would be spreading around the world. And just a month later was the Iron Curtain speech. I think it's very interesting, the speaker as well. Churchill almost gave the speech almost as if he was part of the US State Department saying this. And he had a huge amount of credibility and very, a famous man. And I wonder if this was actually speaking not necessarily to Stalin, but speaking to the Western world. Remember, a year earlier, the Soviet Union was our ally. Our Uncle Joe was helping us defeat the Nazis. And here we are within 18 months or so, we were now saying that they were our enemy and they were pledged to destroy us. And it really changed the direction of policy in America for decades to come.
That policy change seems to have partly been in reaction to Truman's anger against the treatment of Eastern Europe. We've already heard about Poland and arrangements for East Germany. Robin, can you tell us a little bit about Hungary or Czechoslovakia and what happened there under Soviet rule in the late 40s?
Yeah, Stalin's overall approach to Eastern Europe is usually referred to as salami tactics, in which we're seeing bits being sliced off at a time, either through usurpations or rigged elections or assassinations or mysterious deaths. I think what's important to know is that we talk about this as the Eastern Bloc, but that's doing it a disservice, because each of these countries is distinct and it has its own history and culture and language. So each of them react a little bit differently to being liberated by the Red Army after 1945. Poland is a very Catholic country, arguably even more Catholic than Italy is. So it doesn't really receive the message of communism about religion being false. Hungary is also a very strongly Catholic country, and powerful cardinals there shape public opinion. And Hungary was also formerly part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, so they're used to being part of a sort of an old-fashioned monarchical state, so very traditional, very aristocratic. And it has these wonderful cities like Budapest, which Churchill refers to in that Iron Curtain speech as the ancient capitals of Europe. Czechoslovakia is an old one. It is a new creation out of what is the rubble of the Austro-Hungarian Empire after the First World War, so it was a new country. But economically, it's a powerhouse in Eastern Europe. It does have a natural frontier with Germany and a sort of mountain range, and behind that they build up a lot of defences and fortresses and things like this, so they see themselves as being a powerful independent state in the interwar period. They also have very significant arms productions based in the Skoda factory, and that's actually one of the main sources for countries around the world to buy their weapons. So the Czechs are very advanced, very industrialised, very literate, very cultural, and don't take very well to being overrun by Moscow and being told what to do. They don't really see Moscow as being their closest cultural connection. They're much more closely tied to a Vienna or a Berlin, so this is a bit odd for them to be on that side of the fence. And if we even go further south to places like Yugoslavia, a place that had actually liberated itself really from Nazi control, you have a dictator there, Joseph Tito, who's very fondly remembered by people in that region, and actually refused to do what Moscow was telling him to do. So we've got different attitudes towards Moscow, and what Stalin has to do is to try and bring these countries under his rule through a mixture of, I suppose, cajoling, bribery, bullying, assassination. And the key moment, really, I think, is in Czechoslovakia in 1948 with the assassination of Jan Masaryk, the foreign minister, whose father was the founding president of the country. I think that's the moment that's a significant turning point in the history of Eastern Europe and the wider Cold War, because it's the moment that the message that Churchill's given in Missouri and the message that George Kennan is trying to peddle and Truman seems to be waking up to resonates with Americans. They think, if a country like Czechoslovakia can fall through a dodgy death/suicide to communist control, then where else in the world can fall, because it's a powerful capitalist state?
Robin, you've just told us about the fears, especially in America and Britain, about the future spread of communism. And that seems to have led Truman to make an extraordinary commitment regarding the future of Western democracy and capitalism. Sam, can you tell us a little bit about that commitment that Truman makes in 1947 and 1948?
Yes. Before, if I can go back very briefly, before the First World War, before the Second World War, America was very much an isolationist country, did not believe in interfering in other countries, apart from perhaps South America, but leaving the rest of the world to others. So this was a remarkable change of attitude you're about to see from America. And there are three ways that Truman commits the USA into more of a global role. An intervention. This very public policy change, which I'm about to tell you about, the Truman Doctrine, lots of money, and also in a military alliance. So firstly, the Truman Doctrine, 1947, it pledged the USA to support any country fighting communism. So he said famously, "I believe that it must be the policy of the United States to support free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures." There was no hiding who those outside pressures were. And immediately Congress gave $400 million to the monarchists in Greece fighting the communists in Greece. And just as an aside, a very interesting episode in British history there is Britain was propping up the anti-communist forces in that civil war, and we couldn't afford it and asked the Americans to take on that role, another element of our decline. Now, the Truman Doctrine can be summed up in one word: containment, the containment of communism. The second method was through money, and his Secretary of State, George Marshall, an ex-general, went around Europe in 1947 or 46 and was shocked by the poverty. And he identified that there was a link between poverty and communism, that poor people sought to go to the extremes to address their grievances or their poor living standards. And Congress again pledged $13.7 billion to European countries. And they had to request that money. Quite interestingly, it was offered to Eastern European countries as much as to Western. But perhaps not surprisingly, Stalin saw this as a bit of a bribe, a trick to suck in countries like Czechoslovakia, which were Western-leaning, towards America. And there's no doubt that there was a political dimension to the Marshall Plan or the European Recovery Programme, as it's already as it's known. 18 countries benefit from it. And if I can give another little quotation here, this Marshall said, "Its purpose should be the revival of a working economy in the world so as to permit the emergence of political and social conditions in which free institutions can exist." This idea that the people can choose their own institutions is very democratic.
So far, our conversation has focused heavily on Europe. Robin, would you be happy to tell us a little bit about how the Cold War spread into Asia and the importance of China and Korea?
Absolutely. 1949 is a crunch year, and on the face of it, it looks like it's a bad year for Stalin because it's the end of the Berlin blockade, in which is, the Soviet Union comes off very badly. In an attempt to starve out Berlin, of course, he cuts off the road and the rail links, and the Allies fly in an incredible effort, and they airlift supplies that keep the city going. So Stalin eventually has to call it off. So it looks a little bit like, in European terms, the West is doing a lot better. But Stalin actually calls off that blockade because he knows that things are actually shifting focus from Europe, where the battle lines have been pretty much drawn up and the metaphorical Iron Curtain's become an actual Iron Curtain. And instead, things have moved to Asia because some interesting things take place here. Firstly, we have the Chinese Revolution taking place in October 1949. Mao defeats Chiang Kai-shek's nationalists and comes to power. So that provides a major ally. China is still a very underdeveloped country, but nevertheless, in terms of population and potential, it's a significant ally to have. And we need to remember, it's only the second communist revolution that's taken place after the Bolshevik Revolution. So that opens up interesting opportunities. We also see that Korea has been evacuated, having had Soviet forces controlling it at the end of the Second World War in the north and American forces in the south. And now what we have is a civil war about to kick off between North and South Korea. And this becomes what we know as a proxy war, one of those classic Cold War conflicts where the Soviet Union is not directly involved, but they're sponsoring one side, and America might be involved, might not be involved, but they'll sponsor the other side. So we never actually see a kind of a Russian against an American, but we see their allies fighting one another, or perhaps America fighting a Soviet ally and vice versa. So this is what happens in Korea. The North invades the South. And it's at this point that the Truman Doctrine is going to be tested. Will Truman actually back up what he said? Will he come to the aid of the South Koreans, who are almost entirely overwhelmed by the North Korean invasion? And they decide that they will. They go to the United Nations, and because Stalin is boycotting the United Nations because it refuses to recognize Mao's revolution in China as providing a legitimate communist government, it gives the opportunity for the UN very quickly to vote for forces to go into Korea and try to liberate the South. And what we have is a three-year conflict. It's horrendous for Koreans. It's bloody. It swings back and forth in that at first the UN forces under Marshall are able to liberate South Korea, but they push on. Marshall's very much in favour, sorry, not Marshall, MacArthur's very much in favour of what he calls rollbacks, in other words, actually getting rid of and expunging communism. That brings him close to the Chinese border, so Mao's forces suddenly come in and they end up all where they started back at the 38th parallel. But at the end of that war, again, it's a significant moment because the Cold War has spread into Asia. We've had a Chinese Revolution, we've had a Korean War, and we also see at this moment in time the end of two major Cold War protagonists. Truman has done his two terms in office, he's out, and also Stalin dies in 1953, which means that we get this moment where the Cold War, having started in Europe, has moved to Asia. We've got new leaders about to come in. But it is going to spread further into Asia, but it's a question of really what happens next.
By 1949, the USA has lost its nuclear monopoly. Stalin gains the atom bomb. Sam, can you tell us a little bit about the significance of having two nuclear-armed superpowers, and perhaps about how atomic weapons develop and become bigger and more destructive in the 1950s?
The dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were a signal to the Soviet Union that America was on top. And here, I think, the mindset must have changed in Washington, D.C. and the United States, that when Stalin developed an atom bomb himself, that they no longer had the monopoly, or even the hegemony, they were the global leader. And this must have affected their psyche. Particularly as it took place so soon after, for example, the Czechoslovak revolution and so on. And in the United States at this time, there was the Red Scare, where Senator McCarthy was calling in and claiming there were thousands of communist agents in the country. The mindset of, are we losing, must have been evident. And as a result, there became an arms race between the two sides, and it led to the development of different and more powerful bombs, both sides, particularly the hydrogen bomb, which they both gained. And sort of, there was an escalation of tension as a result, as both sides, this clearly could only be built, and it's hugely expensive, to destroy the other side.
The hydrogen bomb seems a truly terrifying weapon. What kind of ways are developed for the to potentially deliver this kind of weapon? I mean, would it have been dropped from a plane, or are there new sort of systems developed?
Certainly, the initial technique was, of course, they would drop from a bomb, drop from a plane, sorry, Enola Gay dropped the bomb over Hiroshima. But as time went on, they did develop missiles, and intercontinental ballistic missiles, or ICBMs, was the route of delivery, which meant you could, someone in Moscow, say, could press a button and it would go off from somewhere in the USSR and fly over continents to America or America's allies to wreak revenge. This did lead to the concept of mutually assured destruction, which was where there was a time lag between the decision to fire, and obviously the firing, and it landing. And that decision time, particularly because of radar, could be the other side could launch a nuclear weapon before they were destroyed. So this, therefore, deterred either side from launching nuclear weapons, which, of course, was excellent for world peace, and did keep a lid on tension and perhaps avoided a direct confrontation between the two sides in the Cold War.
Thank you. And we'll hear a little bit more later about where nuclear missiles bring about a very dangerous crisis. You mentioned before that Stalin had died in 1953, having been ruler of the Soviet Union for many decades. Robin, how was this news received in Eastern Europe, and what expectations do you think East Europeans might have had for how their lives could possibly change under a new ruler? And were they right to have those expectations?
I think so, because Stalin is such a totemic figure in Soviet history, world history, and he's been in power in the Soviet Union for about a quarter of a century, and that has been a tyrannical period of rule. You have to remember that to stay in power in his own country, he ruthlessly persecuted his enemies within the Communist Party, within the military, in a period of the Great Terror in the late 1930s. Anything up to about 8 million people just disappear because they're believed to be opponents of the regime. So Stalin is a terrifying figure. And of course, he has ruled Eastern Europe with an iron fist. And so when he dies, he hasn't nominated a successor. This is the problem you have if you're a paranoid dictator. You don't trust anyone. So if you nominate a successor, you probably expect them to rise up against you. So Stalin has deliberately not done that. And it means that when he dies, no one's quite clear about who is going to rule the Soviet Union. And whoever wins that battle is going to determine what happens in Eastern Europe and in the rest of the Cold War. Of the contenders, one is Stalin's secret police chief, Beria. It's interesting the other figures immediately have him assassinated to rule him out of it, so there won't be Stalin Mark II. So it means of the other figures, the one that emerges in about a three-year battle domestically is Nikita Khrushchev. He's not actually the favourite. A guy called Georgi Malenkov was expected by the West to be the leader of the Soviet Union, but Khrushchev is very jovial, he's very populist, he's from a sort of peasant background in Ukraine, and it seems like he's a very different character. And he does something incredibly brave by marking the end of Stalinism. He gives what he calls a secret speech in 1956. It's not actually secret. He has copies published and disseminated very quickly after he does it. But the idea of this is he's standing up in front of the top levels of the Communist Party, the Central Committee, and denounces Stalin. He said, "We made mistakes. We can't carry on like this. Things need to be different." And that sounds like, okay, fine, it's a turning point, we have a new leader. But to understand just how powerful Stalin was, to criticise him 3 years after he was dead was still considered to be a fatal thing. So actually people faint in shock when they hear Khrushchev publicly criticising Stalin. And because Khrushchev wants that message to get out, you know, the two points of this are, firstly, I'm in charge of the Soviet Union, and secondly, it's going to be different from now on. Everybody in Eastern Europe thinks, fantastic, there might be a bit of a breathing out here. We might get slightly less control by Stalinist supporters. So in lots of the Eastern European countries we've been talking about, they've been ruled by Stalinists who are just, you know, little versions of the big dictator. So there's a hope that those regimes might change, and that who knows what might happen now. Some of these countries might be able to get aid from the Americans. Maybe they might be able to travel abroad or do different things. They might even have free elections, as were promised at the end of the Second World War. So everyone in 1956, when they hear the news of the secret speech and that Khrushchev is in power, thinks this will be really different.
Robin, you mentioned earlier how Poland and Hungary had very strong cultural identities. How was Stalin's speech received in those two countries in particular? Khrushchev's speech.
Khrushchev, yeah, it's very interesting because the Poles are the first ones to react, which is not a surprise given how they've been treated so far. And Khrushchev has this incredible moment where, you know, demonstrations and call for change within the Polish government are taking place. and he lines up the Soviet military on the border with Poland and has a decision to make. Do I negotiate with the Poles and allow them to reform, or do I just send the tanks in and crush them? So actually what they're wanting is just to choose their own communist rulers at this point. It's fairly mild. So in other words, we don't want the Stalinists running us. We'd like to choose our own people. He accepts that, and the Poles change their government. But there's no change to communism overall, and they're still part of the Eastern Bloc, so that's fine. But the Hungarians take it a step further, because they're actually very vocal in their support of the Polish reformers, and students take to the streets and demonstrate openly against Stalinism and against communism. So it's at this point that Khrushchev thinks, right, well, we managed to quell it in Poland, but what's going to happen in Hungary? So the same thing happens again. They line up the forces in case they have to use force. They try to negotiate. And the first reforms are allowed. Again, the Hungarian government changes. Stalinist Rákosi is gone. And his replacement, Erno Gero, is not much better. So they get rid of him as well. And instead, the very populist figure, a man who'd been purged previously, Imre Nagy, comes in. And it seems like Hungary's got the same reform that Poland has, a much more moderate government. But unfortunately, things take a turn for the worse.
Surely the Americans could have come in to help these big popular uprisings against Soviet rule.
You would have thought so, but of course Truman is no longer around. It'd be fascinating to see what Truman would have done in these circumstances. Of course, the whole world is watching to see what Khrushchev will do. You know, will he be more of a carrot or stick man? And what we have in Hungary is the belief that the Americans are coming, because there's a CIA-funded radio station called Radio for Europe, which is broadcasting into Hungary saying, yes, if you rise up, then America will come to your aid. You will get armed support. So things actually develop much greater momentum in Hungary. Students are out in the streets, mentioned already, but other people in society start to join them. Mass protests. And Imre Nagy has this decision to make. He is a communist or a socialist. So does he now back the revolution and break away from the Eastern Bloc and from communism altogether, or does he try to uphold the system and stay friends with Khrushchev? He makes the fatal decision that he is actually going to break away from the Eastern Bloc. And at this point, everyone in Hungary is delighted, they're celebrating, and they think we'll be fine because the Americans will come and help. The problem is that President Eisenhower is not going to risk a world war over Hungary. And Eisenhower really is hoping that he can reach a deal with Khrushchev, especially over Berlin. The Americans don't come to help. Khrushchev decides enough is enough. No one is breaking away from the Iron Curtain. No one is forming a hole in my buffer zone. And in go the tanks. We don't know how many people die in the streets of Budapest, but it is a bloodbath. And it ends up with the complete suppression of the revolution. Imre Nagy disappears and dies. And Hungary remains very firmly in the communist camp.
Khrushchev was able to call on the other Soviet-controlled states in Eastern Europe to crush the Hungarian uprising. Clearly, he totally controlled that military alliance. Sam, could you tell us a little bit about both the military and political alliances that emerged in the East and the West after 1945?
Yes, one of the three alliances that were set up by, in fact, it was by Stalin and Khrushchev, was the Warsaw Pact, and this features twice in the story of the Hungarian uprising. Firstly is Imre Nagy says he's pulling Hungary out of it, and secondly, the Warsaw Pact go in, not just the Soviet Union, but I think Khrushchev was very keen that the Poles and others were involved in a crushing of a popular uprising. They went in to deal with the rebels. So the Warsaw Pact was a military alliance and a response, really, a mirror image to NATO that we've talked about, what I'm about to talk about in a moment. The two other alliances were more to do with their economics and politics. The first one, Comecon, the Council for Mutual Economic Assistance. This was the Soviets' response to Marshall Plan. It sort of worked in a way as a shifting or transferring of products and goods around the Eastern Bloc. So, for example, you might get the Soviet Union would have a surplus of oil and wheat, and they would go to the Eastern Europe, and perhaps the Hungarians might have a surplus of pork, or perhaps not a surplus of pork. And this was this would go to the Soviet Union, and the Hungarian economic factors were certainly a reason for the Hungarian uprising, that they saw goods being transported off to the border with the USSR, and they were hungry and had fewer choices and more rationing at home. So Warsaw Pact, Comecon, and the third one is Cominform, or the Communist Information Bureau, set up in 1947. And this really was a sort of mechanism to for communist parties in Europe, West and Eastern Europe, to communicate and a sort of way for propaganda to be transmitted around. So that was on the Eastern side. On the Western side, you had NATO, the famous North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which is still around today. And this was Western Europe plus Canada and the USA. And it was a military alliance binding the countries together. An attack on one is an attack on all, a very powerful deterrent to any Soviet expansion. And you had two other minor alliances in the world, the Baghdad Pact, which was, as it sounds, Pakistan, Middle East, sort of that area. ASEAN, which was sort of Asia, Malaysia, around that part of Asia. And also the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development in Europe, which was a kind of forerunner to the European Union and sort of a legacy of the Marshall Plan, economic cooperation in Western Europe.
By the end of the 1950s, the world seems to have been very firmly divided. In 1961, the USA gains a new president. He's wealthy, he's young, he's handsome, he's rich. He's the first Catholic president. His name is John F. Kennedy. He seems a very different man to Nikita Khrushchev. Robin, could you tell us about the beginnings of that relationship, and did their relationship get off to a good start?
This is a fascinating one. It's one of the great matchups of the Cold War. Eisenhower is the outgoing president, and he and Kennedy are very different men. Eisenhower, very respected, a very famous general in the Second World War. So he was a Republican president who nevertheless wanted to try and maintain peace as much as possible, I think, in that he hoped to do a deal with Khrushchev over the difficult areas in the world, and particularly over Berlin. He was unable to do that because of the Berlin crisis, and we'll come on to that in just a moment. But when Eisenhower leaves office, you know, he hands things over to the much younger man in Kennedy. And Khrushchev is watching this with great interest. And he thinks that Kennedy is basically a film star and nothing more. Not a very intelligent man, just charismatic. The Americans love a film star, so that's all they've got. They've got a lightweight president who will be easy to push around. And it's fascinating for Khrushchev because, you know, it's the first time he's squared up against an American leader where he feels that his experience in the war, in the Cold War, massively outweighs that of his rival in the White House. So when they first meet up, it is a tense affair. Doesn't go very well.
This is the Vienna conference, isn't it, Robin?
It is. This is in the summer of 1961. And things have already gone a bit wrong for Kennedy. And he does show some naivety and inexperience that Khrushchev suspected. That was over Cuba. And again, we'll go into Cuba in a bit more detail in a little while. But the Bay of Pigs incident had gone horribly wrong for Kennedy and the CIA. So when he turns up in Vienna to meet Khrushchev for the first time face to face, things are very tense. Khrushchev knows that Kennedy has tried to topple his ally Fidel Castro in Cuba, and that they still have this sore issue of what to do with Berlin. So they end up haranguing each other quite severely about their moves in the Cold War. And the conference breaks up really with this dark warning where, you know, they sort of darkly say to each other, if there's going to be war, then it's going to be a long winter.
Robin, you've just mentioned the importance of Berlin. Sam, could you tell us a little bit about what kind of condition East Germany was in at the end of the 50s, early 60s, and what Khrushchev's views were on Berlin and the future of Germany?
Yes, Berlin was in a very, East Germany was in a very poor state, relatively speaking, in the 1950s and up to 61. The country was, it was split in two, Germany was split in two, very artificial boundary. And so East Germans perhaps did not have much loyalty to their fledgling state. And it is estimated that 3.5 million East Germans fled from east to west. That's 20% of the population left this new country, this embryonic country, and which was starting to lose its intrinsic ability to run itself. And many of these people were, of course, skilled workers, young people, families, people who just got their free education. And
how could you get out of East Germany at this time?
Well, by far the easiest way was to just walk down a street in Berlin. Berlin was split into four zones, as you may recall. The three western zones had effectively merged, and there's one eastern zone, which was part of East Germany. And I believe there's something like 20,000 or was it 50,000 30,000 East Berliners had jobs in West Berlin. So literally their commute was getting the tube, the subway, the U-Bahn from their home in East Berlin to West Berlin. Every day they could see full shelves, they could see nice cars, and on their televisions they could see better living standards in the capitalist West. And it's not surprising that so many fled abroad. And this propaganda value for the West of this flight was very galling for the Soviet leadership.
And also, doubtless, for the East German leadership. What kind of worries did Ulbricht and the East German communists have about what might happen?
Do you mean to their economy and to their country? Yes, they were increasingly worried that their state would not evolve in a proper, meaningful way, and they'd be heavily subsidised by neighbouring countries, including the Soviet Union. And I think Ulbricht said very publicly, he said, this emigration just must stop. He didn't say, we won't build a wall. He said, I think a month before the wall was built. But he said, this must stop. And was vague about how he was going to do that.
It would have been fascinating to see what Tempelhof Airport was like as well in West Berlin. I imagine the departure lounge was packed and the arrivals was a sort of dust bowl blowing across an empty, you know, hallway. But you're right, absolutely, the extent to which this is embarrassing for East Germany is incredible. It's the only country in the Eastern Bloc with a declining population and a massive brain drain with it as well. And Ulbricht knows that this is not a sustainable position.
And yet you say that he said that he wouldn't build a wall, and of course we know what happens. When does this wall get built in Berlin, and what do the East Berliners try and do?
Well, it's a very quiet Sunday in the middle of the summer holidays. All the diplomats and military are at home having their lions and playing golf. And suddenly some barbed wire appears along the boundary between the East and West and armed guards. And a few people, East Germans, decide now is the moment. And there's some iconic photographs of people jumping over the barbed wire, children or escaping under it and jumping out of windows because they're so desperate to escape a life in a communist country and want to live in a capitalist country. The propaganda value for the West is superb, and the embarrassment, almost humiliation for communists must have been extreme.
Kennedy condemns the wall, but is there anything else that the Americans actually do to prevent it from being built?
Not that I recall. It's interesting that in some ways, I think building the Berlin Wall eased tension in Europe because this was the last unresolved issue, really, from Yalta and Potsdam, was this sort of rather indefinite border, which was causing a real upset for the East. And by building the wall, Berlin was no longer an issue, and that was pretty good for Cold War tension.
I think from the propaganda side of things as well, you're right, Kennedy doesn't do anything at all, and his great speech made in front of the Berlin Wall doesn't come until 1963, so a little bit late, I would suggest. Also, the Soviet propaganda thing's fascinating. They don't call it the Berlin Wall, they call it the anti-fascist defence boundary, because they try to argue to East Europeans and East Germans that what they're doing is protecting them from fascism, which the West are trying to stir up in West Germany again.
While Berlin and Germany are being plunged into the deep freeze, things are very much hotting up on the other side of the world in the Caribbean. We've already had some brief references to the revolution in Cuba. Robin, can you tell us a little bit about the Americans' attitude towards Fidel Castro, the new pro-communist dictator in Cuba?
Castro's a fascinating individual, and everyone's quick to label him a communist leader, but he doesn't actually become, at least a self-confessed communist, until after he's in power. In reality, he is a Cuban nationalist who sympathises with a nationalist of the late 19th century, a guy called José Martí. And the main issue that Cubans have is that their country is controlled economically and politically by America. And this goes back to 1902, when the Americans had helped Cuba win their war of liberation from Spain. But the American government at that time imposed what was an identical model of the American Constitution and something called the Platt Amendment. It gave the American government the right to control Cuba's foreign policy. So that's what Castro is reacting against when he stages his revolution in 1959. It would be wrong to call him a communist at that point. He's not even a member of the Cuban Communist Party. He is anti-American. So when he comes to power, America knows this means trouble.
And who did Castro remove? You know, what kind of leader had been in place before that?
A guy called Fulgencio Batista. Batista was really a very weak military dictator. Castro had fought an incredible campaign against him in the Sierra Maestra Mountains with a handful of guerrilla warriors, and infamously people like Che Guevara and his brother Raul Castro, now ruling Cuba, are involved in leading brigades there. America realizes that Batista has completely lost the plot when 300 of Castro's men beat 10,000 of Batista's professional soldiers in the mountains, and the game is more or less up. So America thinks, well, how do we handle this guy? What do we do? When Castro then comes to power in 1959, his early moves are to take back businesses and industries in Cuba that are controlled by the Americans, and of those, oil is a very big one. So it's very obvious that Castro is going to be a problem for America, because he has already struck out American businesses and American industry. So this is where a plan is hatched to get rid of him. The Americans don't want their fingerprints all over it. There are plenty of Cubans who don't like Castro, who have emigrated to Florida because they were the ones whose businesses, their nightclubs, their prostitution rackets, everything else, has been lost in the revolution. So they're more than willing to go back and fight Castro, but what they need is a bit of backing. It just so happens the CIA have a few weapons kicking around and a bit of spare time in their hands to train them up, which they do. They pack 1,400 of them off to Cuba. They naively think that because Castro is really unpopular, there will be an uprising against him and he will be deposed in no matter of time. The problem is that Castro is not wildly unpopular, and he has also been given weapons by none other than the Soviet Union. And so, as it happens, these 1,400 Cuban exiles, armed by the CIA, land at the Bay of Pigs and are routed by a force that is actually led by Castro himself using Soviet weapons.
So the Bay of Pigs seems to have been a bit of a disaster for Kennedy. Sam, how does Castro react to this this American-backed invasion? How does it help to develop his friendship with the Russians?
Yeah, I think in two ways, really. Castro uses the invasion as a means to justify his anti-American rhetoric. A lot of Castro's power seems to be built on this we're independent-minded, almost Cuban nationalism. And one could say, ironically, perhaps the Bay of Pigs American foreign policy pushed Castro towards the USSR and to becoming a properly communist country. The embargo, trade embargo, that means the restriction on imports and exports from their biggest trading partner, America, encourages Cuba to look elsewhere for its fuel and its food, and where else but the Soviets, who were very keen to become friendly with them.
The Americans have clearly made no secret of their desire to remove Castro, and Castro doubtless fears further attempts to do this. How does this lead to a military alliance with the Russians, and what help do the Russians send to Cuba?
I think this comes back to Khrushchev, and we almost need to take a slightly backward step with this, because when we said earlier about Khrushchev, when he comes to power and he wants to end Stalinism and everyone thinks good things are about to happen, and instead he crushes the Hungarian uprising, it's a shame, because actually Khrushchev had talked in 1955 about peaceful coexistence. That was his big buzzword that the West seized on and thought, maybe this is a guy we can work with. And so Eisenhower tried to do a deal with him over Berlin. That fell through because of the U-2 incident with Gary Powers. And the West is becoming increasingly suspicious of Khrushchev because he is so unpredictable. There's the infamous moment at the UN where he takes exception to another diplomat's speech and starts jumping up and down on the desk and taking his shoes off and slamming him on the table and screaming, no, no, no. And everyone's terrified because they think, we initially thought this guy might be good news, but now we think he has got the capability to launch ICBMs, and he doesn't really seem to be consistent from one day to the next. One moment he's all about peaceful coexistence, the next moment he's slamming his shoes off the desk. So who is Nikita Khrushchev, and what's going on in his mind? Is he sane? That's what the West are really wondering and scared about.
And in mid-October 1962, Kennedy is shown a file of photographs by the National Security Agency. When that file is opened, Sam, what do those photographs show him?
They show that there are nuclear missiles that could reach almost all of continental USA, are based on this island just 90 miles off Florida. And again, I think this sense of vulnerability, this sense that the invincible America, remember, it's never really been invaded, apart from perhaps by the Mexicans. This must have been a real sort of change in their mindset. So he sees these photographs and this inexperienced president. What does he do? Does he listen to the hawks and decide to invade Cuba again and really sort of remove these missiles by force? Or does he side with the doves, the peacemakers in his cabinet, and try and make compromises with Khrushchev?
And the generals are up for a fight, aren't they?
They certainly are, and it clearly wouldn't be too hard for the United States to invade a Caribbean island. They do have a history of invading Caribbean islands, this would have just been another one, really. But of course, the Soviet Union would not have taken too kindly to its ally being invaded, and at a time of nuclear weapons, this was too much of a risk. And to Kennedy's credit, he listened to both sides of the argument.
Robin, could you tell us a little bit about the option that Kennedy actually goes for?
Yeah, he's in a very difficult position because the obvious thing to do here is to use America's overwhelming military force to squash Castro in Cuba and try to do it as quickly as possible before the Soviets can really react. But as we know, because of mutually assured destruction, there's always the risk that that can get out of hand. So he's being offered a full-on ground invasion by the army. He's being offered a bombing campaign by the Air Force to attack the missile silos. He can also use the Navy, or he can go through the diplomatic channel with the UN and go that way in the hope that things will get better. The thing is, Kennedy has in the back of his mind what happened with the Bay of Pigs when the CIA told him that this would be straightforward. And of course it wasn't. So in other words, if he orders a ground invasion of Cuba, or if he orders a bombing campaign and the military get it wrong, you know, there's no margin for error. That is likely to be a nuclear war. So in the event, he tries to go for a halfway house where he puts this cordon of ships around Cuba, which he refers to as a quarantine rather than a blockade, because after all, the Americans would never do such a thing as a blockade. That's a really Soviet thing to do. The idea is to stop the Soviet ships from getting in. But the whole world is fixated on this at this moment in time because there is this fleet of Soviet ships. They're heading towards Cuba. Everyone knows they've got missiles on them for reasons that historians have never quite managed to work out. I mean, Khrushchev doesn't make any attempt to hide the missiles. They're above board on the ships. So they can be spotted by satellite very easily. So this seems to be an elaborate chess game, and I think in Kennedy's head he must have known that because Khrushchev is not being particularly subtle about this, the end game isn't really to start a nuclear war, it must be something else. So he thinks the best thing to do is blockade Cuba, try and keep the missiles out, but there's the risk of what happens next.
Although Kennedy rejects the military option, it does get very dangerous. Sam, are there points where we do get close to the possibility of actual conflict between the Americans and the Russians?
Yes, an American spy plane or photography plane, it is actually shot down over Cuba at this time, and this certainly put part of the pressure on Kennedy, the military, saying, "This is your excuse. You hear they're shooting down our planes," and this must have been a lot of pressure. There was also the sort of. You can almost feel the ships traveling through the Atlantic, carrying these missiles. What do we getting closer and closer and closer and not turning round? That must have been real pressure on the U.S. presidency.
And how is this all resolved? Because it sounds like we were very close to the edge there, but we stepped back from the brink. What was the solution?
The solution was rather clever, and it did reflect very well on Kennedy, was that the Khrushchev promised to take nuclear weapons out of Cuba, and in return, America promised not to invade Cuba. In other words, the Soviet Union would keep its ally, its communist ally, on the edge of America, and indeed, it's still there. And also, there was a secret part of the deal where America would remove its nuclear missiles from Turkey. This is not quite a quid pro quo, because the missiles in Turkey were a bit obsolete and were not really necessary. The Americans had enough missiles to get to the Soviet Union without having these missiles in Turkey.
Finally, can you both just give us one or two examples of how tensions reduced a little bit after the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Yeah, I think both leaders recognised that this was far too close for comfort, and there are other moments in the crisis which we don't have time to go into where, you know, things could have gotten an awful lot worse, but the diplomatic back channel works. But the problem is that if America wants to talk to Russia, if Moscow wants to talk to Washington, then there's no actual formal way to do that. I mean, you can talk through ambassadors, but it's not a really quick or effective way of doing it. So one of the key things they do is install a hotline so that the American president can talk to the leader of the Soviet Union directly over, you know, the telephone, and they can resolve their issues should they get to this stage ever again.
And Sam, am I right in thinking that they stopped doing these big tests in the atmosphere of hydrogen bombs?
Yes, in 1963, very soon afterwards, they pass this nuclear test ban treaty, which does exactly what it says on the tin, and it does de-escalate the situation around nuclear weapons in the Cold War.
Robin McPherson, Sam Guttridge, thank you very much for talking today about the Cold War, 1945 to 1962.